Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of KleptoCast, the podcast series from the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. My name is Casey Michelle, and my guest today is Zhek Ischaki, a senior researcher for Nations in Transit, which is Freedom House's annual survey of democratic governance in the post-communist space. Zhek has prior worked with organizations like the European Parliament and Amnesty International, but much of her recent research has focused on Hungary, whose government, led by Prime Minister Viktor Orban, has enacted some of the most illiberal legislation the EU has seen over the past few years, much of which has paralleled similar legislation we've seen play out in Moscow under Russian President Vladimir Putin. So, Zhek, it's great to have you with us today. Before digging into some of the recent legislation pushed out of Budapest, can you give us just a bit of background on Orban himself, how he got his start, some of his positions prior to becoming prime minister, and whether his illiberal leanings have been there from the start?
Hi, Casey. Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. It's great to be here. Yes, I think it's good that you started with Orban, because I think that he's a fascination for many people. Mm-hmm. And there is certainly, a reason behind that. So he started out back he appeared in politics back in 1989 with a very famous, speech. And in that speech, he said that, he basically called on Russian troops to go home, mm-hmm. which was a very, very brave act back then. And then he has been in Hungarian politics ever since. So he's probably one of the politicians who has been involved in Hungarian politics for the longest time. And I do have to say that he is a very talented, a very skilled politician. So no reason that he stayed in politics for this long, and no reason that he's, in a sense, he is one of the most successful politicians of the region, because he has won many elections and he's popular. He's still popular. So he started out as a liberal. I think most listeners know that. But then Fidesz changed course around, in the mid-1990s, when they realized that there is a space that can be filled in, a conservative, right-leaning space. And they were in power back in 1998, 2002. And after that, they lost the election by a hair's breadth, so by a very narrow margin. And that defeat stayed with Orban for a long time afterwards. So he, there are many theories, but one says that he basically blamed the media for that defeat. Uh-huh. Because he did not have, at the time, he did not have this media background, the support that, of course, by now he has.
Sure.
And so they very, purposefully, they started building up media outlets. They started pouring money, or, oligarchs close to them, business people close to them, started pouring money into outlets. And so by 2010, when they came to power again, they had a supporting right-leaning media environment, a bunch of outlets.
Okay. So it's 2010 is the return to power. There is this kind of media infrastructure that you were just mentioning that's come along with in support. And we're looking at 7 years in power of Orban and Fidesz now. It's not exactly been a secret that Orban's been seeking to construct this quote-unquote illiberal state. I mean, he said as much, or I guess that was the term he used pretty explicitly back in 2014 when he pointed to countries like China and Russia and Turkey as potential models that he would like to see come to pass in Hungary. From your perspective, Zhek, what are some of the pieces of legislation you've seen that stick out as examples of this push from Orban and Fidesz toward this illiberal model?
Mm-hmm. So, yes, you're right. That legislation was definitely a big part of this push. also because Fidesz is made up of lawyers. So it's a party that that very keenly knows that, you know, that you can change legislation to some extent and then even walk back when the European Parliament, when the European Union or other international bodies criticize you, mm-hmm. but still have laws in place that that benefit you. And so, yes, it started legally or in a, with legal tools in the media. And back then it started first with the change of, or with the new constitution, and then with the media law. But Fidesz also overhaul the institutional framework of the judiciary. So it overhauled the constitutional court, changed the law on the court. Now the constitutional court, is much bigger than the previous court. Of course, it has Fidesz loyalists, on the court. And so in the first, let's say, 3, 4, maybe 5 years, the party passed legal measures, many, as much as I think there was a year when they passed 800 pieces of legislation or something like that.
Okay. Keeping busy. Yeah.
Yeah. And changed the legal structure, in many sectors.
Yeah.
But by, let's say, 2015, they changed course, for example, in the media. And that's important that many of the laws when they were first passed, they clearly violated international standards. But after a while, you know, they changed some things and these are still restrictive laws. But when you look at them, they are not that clearly against international standards. There are a few problematic provisions in each of them. And of course, that's the clever thing about Fidesz, that this turns into a system then that's, well, illiberal.
Yeah, right.
But if you look at the details, it's not so clear. And then since 2015, they have changed in some sense. First, that, for example, in the media, they have started using ownership as a political tool instead of using legislation. So acquiring outlets, suspending or closing down outlets eventually, or, you know, purely for economic reasons, of course. And then this year is certainly there is a change of this method of using the law, because this is the first year when, you know, with the Lex CEU, the law on Central European University and this draft law on NGOs.
Sure.
That is clearly against Western European democratic standards.
Yeah. And I had a couple questions that I wanted to get to get your perspective on some of the developments we've seen this year and especially over the past few months. And that kind of leads me into my next question is obviously these policies don't exist in a vacuum, and it's clear that Budapest has just broadening out. It's become one of Moscow's closest partners, if not potentially the closest partner for Moscow in the EU. Before we get to talking about the new legislation that has been proposed in Budapest, can you talk just a bit about Budapest's relationship with Moscow and how that has impacted Orban's relationship and Fidesz's relationship with the rest of the West, and maybe even how that's impacted Moscow's relationship with the West?
Yeah, so that's an important topic, and I think that it has to be clarified in the beginning that Hungary is not an important country for Russia, of course.
Okay.
I mean, Hungary is a small country. Mm-hmm. It's important in a sense that it's a member of the European Union, and that Russia has some leverage over Hungarian politics. We don't know the extent, the true extent of that leverage. And this is my personal take on it, but I think that Orban and his government, they are not pro-Russian because they have any kind of, you know, because they think that Putin is this great leader and we should definitely copy him. I think that on their part, it's more a flawed assessment of the current situation and of Hungary's place in the world. Because I think that, that they approach it in a way, as if Hungary was a country that could benefit from both from EU membership and from an economic relationship with Russia.
Yeah, right.
And I think that they are making a big mistake in that. Now, that's another question that recently these policies that they have started copying, these laws, are really very similar. To the NGO law passed in Russia. So there might be much more to it. As I said, it's just hard to know the extent of the leverage that Russia has on Orban or on Fidesz. And it's also hard to know, recently there have been some articles about Russian presence in Hungary, but this is fairly new. In the past, it was very difficult to really judge Russian presence in Hungary.
Yeah, but there have been a recent round of new reports and new articles detailing some more of that relationship, or at least developments within that relationship.
Yes. So recently they have started reporting about potential spy stories, especially collusion with the far right groups, and that's definitely, that's how Russia operates in many other countries. We know that. So that's definitely something that has to be paid more attention to.
So, yeah.
What was interesting, although, because I did say that, Hungary is not an important country from Russia's perspective, but what was definitely interesting that this year, when Putin came to visit in February, I believe, the same day that he landed, an article was published in, I can't remember which Russian newspaper, a fairly long article saying that back in the 1990s, Orban personally took some money from Russian sources, which was new. This method was new. This clearly looked like pressure.
Yeah, right.
What was behind it? It's hard to tell.
Sure. Taking money in the sense of the kind of model we saw with France's National Front in terms of a bank loan, or were these interpersonal financing that this report came out and revealed?
I believe it was about meeting with some criminal figures.
Ah, okay. Sure.
We're connected to the underworld.
Right. So, okay, well, that's I guess a story for another time as well, but yes. Certainly an interesting data point. But turning back, Jacques, we've been kind of discussing to an extent the policies that have come to pass thus far in Budapest over the past few years. But just as you mentioned a moment ago, there are a pair of policies that were recently proposed that are very similar to certain policies we've seen out of Moscow, and those are the NGO, recent pieces of NGO legislation, as well as the Lex Law, the new legislation proposed that would target the Central European University, which I believe is your alma mater, correct?
Yes, that's great.
Yeah. So can you give us a bit of details? Can you talk a bit about what these pieces of legislation propose and how viable you think either of them are moving forward?
So the common characteristic for both pieces of legislation is that both of them are presented as connecting to George Soros and his activity in Hungary, because Central European University back in the 1990s was founded by an endowment, through an endowment by Soros himself. Now, it has been rumored for a long time, before LexEU was published, that there might be an attack on the university, but everyone thought that, it's so far-fetched that these are just rumors. Mm-hmm. And it's important that next year, this time, so in next April, there will be elections. which means that these laws are actually the start of a, as it seems, a very long campaign season. And so the law on CAU that was already passed, that would make the operation of the university as it is in Hungary currently practically impossible, because it obliges the university to open a campus in New York, a fully functioning campus by, if I'm correct, by next January.
Okay.
And it would also oblige the U.S. authorities to agree on the operations of the university with the Hungarian authorities, but on the federal level. Now, education is, these agreements are not made on the federal level,
right.
But on the state level. So right now this law is, in front of, or under European, the European Commission has started an investigation into it.
Okay.
This investigation has a deadline upcoming in 3 weeks, if I am correct. So there is a chance that by then it might be amended, withdrawn. I believe that there is still a chance.
Yeah.
Just because there was such a big uproar. And probably by now the government has realized that it has a lot to lose.
Uh-huh.
But we never know because Fidesz has been very clever in playing its European partners. So they promised to amend the law. They promised it to their parliamentary grouping, the EPP. And the same day when Orban came back, he said, oh, no, we did not promise something. So,
well,
so we'll see, but I have some hopes for now.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, and but as for the NGO law, that is still being prepared. That's a draft that's in front of the parliament.
Okay.
I think it's supposed to vote on the law this week, next week, sometime around this time. I think it might move together with like CAU. So if there is some backtracking on that, there might be some backtracking on the NGO law, which is essentially a foreign agents law, very similar to Russia's legislation.
Right.
Although the text says that these NGOs would have to be called foreign financed organizations, so not agents per se. But every government politician uses the term agent organization when they talk about these NGOs.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that some of the pushback we've seen out of Brussels, but also domestically. I mean the protests we've seen over the past few weeks, past month or so now. They've certainly been impressive. Some of the biggest we've seen during Orban's run as prime minister. I mean, Jake, you mentioned that the elections are coming up in April. Have you gotten any sense one way or the other that the political tide in Hungary, I mean, it may be turning, and the kind of the basic support structure for Fidesz over the past few years may be starting to shift, or is that perhaps a too optimistic outlook moving forward?
I think it's a bit too optimistic.
Okay.
I think in the first few days after the protests, there was definitely a sense that something has changed, because there were many people, even from the political right and former Fidesz supporters, who spoke out against these laws, against CAU, but also against the NGO law. So there was a feeling that something is slowly changing, that Fidesz might have gone a bit too far.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important that for Fidesz, intellectuals are not the most important voter group.
Sure.
So they always say that, there are these intellectuals, but we are aiming at convincing regular people, the people of Hungary, as populists do.
Yeah, not just and, the elites. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And there has not been that big of a shift in Fidesz's support.
Okay.
So that's the difficult thing, that there are many people who by now, you know, have decided that they can never support Fidesz.
Okay.
But the core voter group, the core supporters of the party are still there.
Yeah.
And because of the changes, which I actually forgot to mention, because of the changes to the electoral laws, whichever party gets the biggest, the highest number of votes, that party will gain a majority much more easily. And the opposition only has a chance if there is one single actor that they can support.
Okay.
And I don't see that happening because, you know, right now there's Jobbik and then there are many smaller left-leaning parties.
Sure.
So,
yeah,
you know, there was definitely a feeling of hope a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
But then by now, I think it's all back to normal, more
okay.
or less.
Yeah.
We'll see if Fidesz keeps pushing this way.
Yeah.
Because the hate campaign has really, really become ugly over the past few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Then we might see more protests and then we might see some changes.
Yeah. Okay.
But for now, not so much.
Just as a, I guess related to that, and Jackie, just as a final question, you know, some of the pushback again wasn't only domestic in terms of public protesting, but we did see action out of Brussels, threats of lawsuit, that much more pushback from EU officials. I just wanted to get your sense. Where does Brussels fit in all this? What kind of policies can they implement moving forward to kind of encourage a rollback of this illiberalism? And do you have any sense whether or not the EU, you know, even if the political tides in Hungary itself potentially aren't turning, if there's any reason to think that EU officials may become more assertive in attempting to roll back some of these policies?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a difficult question because we have seen with Poland that that the EU has certain weapons, that namely Article 7, which is this procedure which can result ultimately in suspending a member state's voting rights, but in many other sanctions as well. But what we have seen in Poland is that European institutions have not being brave enough to use these measures because they fear that might isolate these countries. And so in the end, it's nothing really happened. And at the same time, the EU is losing face over these scandals. In the case of Hungary, I think that because right now there is an ongoing procedure, if in the end Fidesz does not change these laws, I think that in that case there is a chance that that the political grouping, this EPP in the European Parliament, might get as frustrated as to oust Fidesz from its members.
Okay.
Which, you know, if you, it doesn't sound like such a big thing. But that would be a big blow to Fidesz and to Orbán, who like to say that, you know, in the European Parliament and generally in Europe, they are part of what's going on.
Yeah.
And if they were ousted, that would be a completely different situation.
Okay.
Then they would be isolated for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, the European Union has weapons at its disposal.
Yeah.
Article 7 as well as this rule of law procedure that they started against Poland. And ultimately, these can be powerful weapons because both Poland and Hungary, these are the countries where the population is the most pro-EU among all European member states.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that it's really hard to use these measures cleverly because these governments can easily say that, you know, as the Hungarian government is saying in a campaign, that Brussels is attacking us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very tricky game to play.